Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 38. I'm recording it on Monday, November 3rd, 2008. The PE10 level today is 16. That's just slightly above fair value. Stocks purchased today offer a strong long-term value proposition. The title of this podcast is The Future of Investing, Part 2. I did a series of podcasts earlier called Passive Investing is the Most Emotional Investing Approach of All. And that one went four parts. They were each about 60 minutes. So I recorded about 4 hours of material. And in that podcast, I traced the history of how I came to believe that passive investing is the enemy of the middle class investor. And I noted, I discussed 35 steps along that journey, 35 things I discovered during the first 6 years of the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate. And this series of podcasts, titled The Future of Investing, I try to take the other side of the story, not the other side, in that I'm certainly not defending passive investing, but the positive side of the story rather than the negative. There was a bit of a focus on the negative in that earlier series because I was looking at 35 things that led me to believe that passive investing is a disaster for the middle class investor. With this series, I'm looking forward and trying to identify 35 changes that are needed to bring about the shift from the discredited passive investing model to the rational investing model, which I view as the investing model of the future. The difference between the two models, just so that you know, that newcomers here understand what we're talking about, is passive investing is the dominant model of today. Passive investing is the model responsible for this $8 trillion loss that investors have experienced in the past 12 months. It's the investing model responsible for the price crash that we've recently experienced. Passive investing is the investing philosophy that says there is no need to pay attention to valuations when making your stock allocation decisions, that no matter how high prices go, it's perfectly fine just to stick with your same old stock allocation, an allocation that you probably decided on when stocks were much more reasonably priced. The rational investing model is just the opposite. The rational investing model says we must pay attention to valuations, that understanding valuations is the key to successful long-term investing, and that the single thing that middle-class investors do that most affects whether they are successful or not is the setting of their stock allocation. So to ignore valuations when setting your stock allocation, or to fail to adjust your allocation when we see dramatic changes in prices, is a terrible, terrible mistake. And my belief is that intellectually, we have available to us today all that we need to know about investing. I certainly favor additional research. We want to see new research going on all the time so that we learn even more. But we know what we need to know. We know what we need to know for the typical middle-class investor to invest successfully and without having to put a lot of time into the project of learning about particular stocks or anything like that. But there's one big obstacle holding us back, and that's the popularity of the passive investing concept, which is a purely emotional approach. And today we have many quote-unquote experts who, although they are aware that there is academic research showing that the efficient market theory, which is the intellectual framework for passive investing, does not stand up to scrutiny. We've had academic research along those lines for 20 years or more. Many of these experts are reluctant to acknowledge that the investing advice that we've all been relying on for the past 20 or 30 years is terribly, terribly flawed. So we're in a sort of twilight zone. And the purpose of the 35 items that I'm going through in this series of podcasts is to point to things that we need to see happen during a national debate on investing to help bring about the shift from passive investing to rational investing, the future of investing. All right. The first five items, real briefly, the first item I mentioned in the earlier podcast was that we should have, when the S&P number is reported or when the Dow number is reported, we should report not only the nominal number, we should report a price-adjusted number so that investors know when stocks are becoming truly dangerous. Second, I advise that we should be using calculators to learn about investing, not just reading articles or listening to podcasts. We should be using calculators so that we can experience ourselves what a difference changes in valuations make on the returns that we obtain in the long term. And that those calculators, of course, need to be valuation adjusted. They need to be analytically valid calculators. Third, I argued that we need to see more of a focus put on the behavioral finance school. Behavioral finance teaches us that emotions affect investing results. And during the passive investing era, the findings of the behavioral finance researchers have been downplayed. We need to put more focus on that. Four, I urged work in what I call behavioral finance 2.0, which is the type of work that I do at the PassionSaving.com site, where I comment on things going on in discussion boards, because on internet discussion boards, we see how real live investors take the theories, you know, drummed up by quote unquote experts and apply them in the real world. We see what works in the real world on investing boards. We see what helps investors gain confidence, and we see what causes investors to become defensive and even angry. What causes investors to fail? What causes investors to become overly emotional about their investing strategies? And five, I talked about the importance of those three magic words, I was wrong. Probably the biggest problem we have today is that so many of today's investing experts have advocated passive investing in the past. And in order for us to see a shift to the investing model of the future, those experts need to acknowledge the mistakes they've made. That's a key part of the learning process. How many times in your life have you been wrong about something and you resisted saying it and you resisted saying it and things got worse and worse and worse, and finally you just broke down in agony and you said, I was wrong, and then things started to change. It's that old saying, it's always darkest before the dawn. It's darkest before the dawn because it's so hard for humans to admit when they've made mistakes. But once they do admit it, that's when their mind becomes open to all the good information, all the healing information. So we need a healing process. And what will get a healing process started are those three magic words. I was wrong. Number six, the sixth item that will lead us toward a new, more sensible and more realistic understanding of how stock investing works in the real world. We need to use saving insights in the investing realm. This is something I want to explore in future articles at the site. I think I'm probably going to do a podcast just on this question at some point. I often look back at myself and I say, the way I pose this question is, I in one of the chapters of the book I'm writing on investing, I kick it off with a sentence: how did I get to be so smart? You know, how is it that Rob Bennett, he's proposing a new model of stock investing, and Rob Bennett discovered the flaws in the old school safe withdrawal rate studies, and Rob Bennett came up with an approach to indexing better than John Bogle's approach, valuation-informed indexing. Rob Bennett is questioning the experts. He's saying that the experts should acknowledge that they were wrong. Who is this? Who is this Rob Bennett individual, and how did he get to be so smart? Well, I'm obviously not smarter than the experts, not in an IQ sense, not even close. But I think a big thing for me is that there's all sorts of answers to that question. And I did an earlier podcast, Rob Bennett, the Reluctant Investing Expert. So I discussed that topic a little bit there. But one of the things is I didn't have a background in investing. People, my critics, they look at me and they say, Rob Bennett didn't study investing in school. Rob Bennett doesn't manage a multi-billion dollar fund. Rob Bennett can't question the experts. He has no standing. Well, If I had done those things, I would have had to take the same test that all those experts took. They would have asked me questions. Is it necessary to change your stock allocation when prices go to high levels? And I'd have to put, no, not necessary. Passive investing has proven this scientifically. The efficient market theory says the market always knows best. You see, I would have given those answers. I would have been required to give those answers to pass the test. But I never took those tests. I'm being slightly facetious here, but the point I'm trying to get across is, I think, a valid one. The experts are handicapped by what they've learned. We tend to think of experts as being better informed than everyone else, and they are better informed in the sense they've read more books. But what if the books got it wrong? When we're dealing with the passive investing error, we're talking about a model for understanding how stock investing works that has been discredited, that has been proven to have been wrong. Valuations do affect long-term returns. The market is not efficient. So one big edge I had is that I had not learned all those things, and I was not emotionally invested in defending those ideas. But the other thing is that what got me interested, to the extent I was interested in investing, was saving. My field of expertise is saving money. The book that I've already written is a book on saving. And so that's how I came to this. And one of the reasons passive investing strikes me so strangely is that for years I was a poor saver. You've heard that story from so many people. And, you know, a light switch went off in my brain when I started to save effectively. And I learned, what so many people go through when they become effective savers is they learn they can make their life so much better by managing their money well. Well, when I learned that lesson, I didn't forget it. So I was a person who knew virtually nothing about investing. All I knew was what anyone knows from, you know, listening to television and reading magazines, reading a few books. But then I learned all this material about saving. I spent years studying saving. I had dozens of binders of material, and I wrote budgets, and I would revise my budgets, and I would talk about this with my friends. Then I turned to investing, and I said, well, I've saved all this money. I want to make this job shift where I need to be able to count on income from my investments to live on. How should I go about doing that? Should I just follow the conventional advice? And then I noticed that the conventional advice ignores price. And the thing that I had learned when I became an effective saver is that price matters. You don't want to be spending your money thoughtlessly. You want to get the most mileage out of your money possible. Isn't that what saving is all about? It's about, you know, effective savers don't say that you should never spend money. If you never spent money, you'd be a hermit somewhere. So we all spend money. But the idea is to assess value propositions. You want to get value for your money. But then I go to the investing realm, and what do I read? Don't pay attention to valuations. Buy stocks no matter what the cost. Oh, you know, if your retirement fails, tighten your belt. I'm like, what? I don't want my retirement to fail. I want accurate numbers in my retirement studies. I don't want it to fail, so I have to tighten my belt. I understand that if my retirement doesn't work, I could try to tighten my belt, but I don't want to do that. I want to make an effective retirement plan, a successful plan. And I don't want to throw money at stocks when they offer a poor long-term value proposition. I want to buy stocks that are going to help me. I want my money to go as far as it can go. Well, I'd like to see everyone who writes in the investing realm take the lessons that people have learned in the saving realm and apply them to investing. If using your money effectively when spending it works, well, using your money effectively when investing should work as well. Why not? So we need to learn prudence in the investing realm. We need to learn effective money management. We need to learn the value, you know, the merit of getting a good value proposition. All these things. And an analogy I use when talking about bull markets, the rational investor hates bull markets because bull markets are first of all what cause bear markets, and bear markets hurt us all. So if we want to eliminate bear markets, we have to eliminate bull markets. And all that bull markets are is borrowing from the future. Bull markets are equivalent to credit card spending. What we're doing in a bull market is we're saying, oh, stocks return in the U.S., that stocks have always returned about 6.5% real per year. That's the average return. We're not satisfied with that. We want more than that. 6.5, that doesn't do it for us. We want double that. We want 13%. So we'll borrow from the future. And we'll get 13% now, and some year in the future we'll get 0%. But then, of course, 13 isn't enough. Then we say, oh, we want 20. And that means we'll have a negative 7% some year in the future. And then we say, oh, 20 is not enough. We want 25. And the negatives get bigger and bigger and bigger until we get to a point where we have to have a negative 40% like we did over the past 12 months. Well, I say, kerplooey on that. I mean, I'm not interested in a negative 40%. What's wrong with a steady 6.5%? And forget this negative percent, 40%, and forget this zero return and all this other nonsense, which hurts us as people and which hurts the economy. You know, this recession is being caused by the fact that stock prices have crashed, and stock prices would not have crashed had we only had the experts telling us to behave responsibly back in the 1990s. If the experts had been telling us, pull your money out of stocks, lower your stock allocation, that would have brought stock prices down back when they were first getting out of control, and we never would have seen this stock crash that we're living through today. So, all the things we have learned in the saving realm don't apply only in the saving realm. They apply in the investing realm as well. And there's no reason why, you know, I don't believe in pride of authorship. I don't believe these investing experts should be saying, oh, we didn't come up with the idea of managing your money responsibly. That's a saving idea. We can't apply that here. That's not for us. No, it is for us. If it works in the saving realm, it works in the investing realm. Managing your money responsibly makes sense no matter what you're doing with it. Investors should be aiming to obtain a strong value proposition on their money every bit as much as savers do. My take. Item number 7 on the shift, on what we need to achieve a shift from passive investing to rational investing. We need new personality types in giving us advice on investing. Now, I've talked about this in earlier podcasts. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but I don't recall the title of the podcast in which I talked about the difference between using the Myers-Briggs personality indicator. We have the INTJ type is the type that is most prevalent in among investing experts, and I mentioned that I am an INFJ, a feeler, rather than a thinker. And that makes a big difference. Thinkers are more inclined to rely on studies. They're more inclined to rely on statistical analysis. And we see a lot of that among the people who built the passive investing model. Feelers are more inclined to look at what happens to people. We're more alert to seeing the human misery caused by these irresponsible strategies. So the thinkers among us will look at the human misery and they'll say, well, you know, we'll have to live with that. That's sad, but you know, that's just what you have to crack some eggs if you want to make an omelet. But look at these studies. Aren't they great? We don't want to have to redo these studies. These studies, oh, they're a work of art. They're beautiful. All these numbers. None of that queasy stuff. None of that gushy, yucky, emotional stuff. It's numbers. And the feelers will say, no, no, no. Investors are humans. Investors have lives. And if you use numbers that are inaccurate because you didn't include the effect of emotions on your investing results, then the numbers aren't going to work. All those pretty studies with the pretty tables and the pretty graphs will just cause more human misery. And that's not good. That's not acceptable. We need the thinkers. We don't want to do away with the INTJs. We don't want to do away with, I don't think we really want to do away with the efficient market theory. The efficient market theory is wrong. But it generated insights that are valuable. It helped us get to where we are today. So we don't want to do away with it. We always want to discuss it and what we learned from it, just as we always want to discuss the old school safe withdrawal rate studies. But we don't want to rely on the efficient market theory for our investing advice. We want our investing advice to be based on a variety of inputs. Efficient market theory, where it can generate helpful guidance, sure, let's take advantage of it. But where it leads to bone-crushing losses, like the type we've experienced over the past 12 months, well, no, no, no. We don't want that. We need to also pay attention to the other side of the investing story, which is that investing isn't just numbers. Investing is also human emotions. And we only know about the effect of human emotions by looking at valuations. That's where human emotions evidence themselves, in the numbers. So if we're going to do investing analysis, we need to include in that analysis the effect of valuations. If we fail to include valuations, we haven't done the job. We haven't done the job. And as long as the investing realm is populated almost exclusively by INTJs and similar personality types, engineers, economists, statisticians, these types, we're never going to get the full picture. We need people with different perspectives. We need more personality types in the investing realm, so that when the INTJs make mistakes, there will be someone there to see the mistakes and to point them out and to get them corrected. Item number 8 on the future of investing, systems engineering. I can't speak in any detail about systems engineering, but it's one of the topics that came up in the article that I discussed in podcast number 35. The podcast on the article by David Brooks on the behavioral revolution. And one of the comments that was filed by readers of the article at the New York Times, someone talked about systems engineering. And I mentioned in my discussion of that in podcast 36, podcast 36 was where I discussed the comments filed on that article. I mentioned that John Walter Russell has an article on systems engineering and how it helped him to see the flaws in the passive investing model at his website. Go to John's website, early-retirement-planning-insights.com. John has a search box And if you enter systems engineer, something like that, or systems engineering, I believe that you will turn up that article. And John talks about how he used systems engineering concepts in the work he did before his retirement, and how he used those same ideas to identify the flaws in the passive investing model and to learn what works in the rational investing model. And why not use this information we have? There's such a thing out there as system engineers, people who look for flaws, people who take this is process, this is not substance. These are not people who are biased against passive investing. They don't have any reason to not like passive investing. They just know how the world works. And they've studied it. And they've learned how to find where systems of thought break down. And the passive investing system of thought is a system of thought that has broken down. It is a system of thought that has failed us. Well, the systems engineers can help us. They can help us learn what's good about passive investing, what's bad about passive investing, how to fix what's bad, how to come up with a better model. Item number 9 on our effort to shift to a more realistic investing model. We need to create a database of fallacies. Something I've learned so many things in my time on discussion boards talking about investing. And I learned things that I certainly did not expect to learn going in. And I feel that this is where I can have the greatest impact, because I'm not a person, I don't talk about the sophisticated investing strategies. I don't talk about them because I don't know anything about them. I study what I study, and what I'm interested in is the basics. I want to reform our understanding of the fundamentals of investing, the ABCs, not the advanced stuff. I had a guy, I won't go into it, but I had a guy at indexuniverse.com who, he was deciding whether to run an article that I wrote on valuation-informed indexing, and he didn't want to run it because of political pressure. He had Mel Lindauer and his friends at the bogleheads.org site putting pressure on him not to run this article because it makes them look bad that they banned discussion of valuation-informed indexing. And the publisher at Index Universe thought the article was fine. And the editorial guy didn't want to run it. And he said, I have these standards I use, but I can't apply those standards in your case, Rob, because if I applied those standards, I would run the article, and I can't run it. He didn't say that, but that was between the lines. That's what he was saying. And at one point he just got so desperate, he started trying to ask me questions, and I would of course respond to his questions, give him answers, and he couldn't come up with any reason, and he finally said, you'll need to discuss Sharpe ratios. If I'm going to run an article, I've got to have Sharpe ratios in there. Well, there's no discussion of Sharpe ratios in my article on, an introduction to valuation-informed indexing. And there's no need for discussion on Sharpe ratios. It has absolutely zero to do with the topic. You're never going to hear Rob Bennett discuss Sharpe ratios. Bruce Springsteen, he once said, if I ever appear on one of these in these giant stadiums, he used to play small clubs, of course, when he was starting out. He said, if I ever appear at one of these giant stadiums, I hope somebody shoots me. Well, if I ever start discussing Sharpe ratios on my podcast, I hope somebody shoots me. But the point here is, that's not my thing. I discuss the basics. I think I have something to contribute on the basics, but not on Sharpe ratios. But one of the things I learned is that I think a lot of people, a lot of middle-class investors, they think they're intimidated by the experts. They think the experts know things they don't know. And they're wrong, but I know why they think that, because I used to think that. When I first discovered the flaws in the safe withdrawal rate studies, the old-school studies, at first I wasn't sure I was right. That's why I came to a discussion board and I at Motley Fool, and I wanted to get feedback from others. I wanted to check it out. Am I right? And then after I learned I was right, I thought it was just a question of explaining it to people. Once I explained it, they would change the studies. They would fix the studies. But no. And then I thought, oh, well, I need to get the experts. If I alert the experts, they will step in and they will want the studies corrected. And I contacted Scott Burns and contacted William Bernstein and contacted John Bogle. But no, Jonathan Clements. No, they weren't interested in correcting the old school studies. And that's when it started to dawn on me. This is that earlier set of podcasts. How I learned that passive investing is the enemy. What I started to learn is that passive investing isn't just an investing strategy. It's a way of thinking. And if you buy into that way of thinking, you don't want to have accurate numbers because accurate numbers undermine the whole project. You don't want people to know what numbers to use for their retirements. Now, no one would say that, and no one would even think it. So clearly, you know, as I state it, what they do is they sense that, wait a minute, this new school stuff is a little too accurate. It's starting to worry me. It's making me nervous. It doesn't sound like what I've been telling people. It sounds like I got, and then they just sort of black it out. Well, it's not that important to get the numbers right. And oh, the old school studies, that's a rule of thumb. And if the retirements fail, they can tighten their belts. They get into all this excuse making. Because it just makes them too queasy. Well, one of the things I learned is that there are certain fallacies that are repeated over and over and over again by investors and by experts trying to defend the passive investing model. So I think a great thing to do would be, to the extent I can do it at my website, I'll try to do it, but you know, there's only so many hours in a day, and there are limits to what I can do. But I hope someone will create a database of all of these fallacies. And that would allow people who were trying to develop a better understanding of investing, they'd have a place to go to. Sort of like, you know, this Snopes site, Snopes.com. There's a website I don't read it all that often, but I've seen it referenced many times where people will be talking about some kind of urban myth, and they will go to this Snopes.com site, and they will, you know, they'll present factual evidence. Is the claim being made? Is it realistic? Is it based on reality, or is it just crazy talk? Is it some made up thing? Well, that's what we need on investing. We need a Snopes.com for all these investing fallacies. I can give lots of examples. I could do a whole podcast on this, but I'll give one or two just to give you the idea. One is there was an interview done with Benjamin Graham. Benjamin Graham, he's the author, the co-author of the book Security Analysis, which is the Bible of investing, how to invest. A book written a long time ago, I believe in the 1930s. And that's, you know, Benjamin Graham is the person that Warren Buffett learned how to invest from. And Benjamin Graham is the person who came up with the PE10 concept, the valuation metric we use at PassionSaving.com. So Benjamin Graham is a giant. And Benjamin Graham does not favor passive investing. Benjamin Graham understands that you need to look at valuations. And Benjamin Graham is really the first person to have recommended what I call valuation-informed indexing. Now, indexing didn't even exist in Benjamin Graham's time, but what he recommended was that investors change their stock allocations in response to changes in valuation. So he said you might go with a 75% stock allocation when prices are low, and lower it to 50% when prices are moderate, and then lower it to 25% when prices are sky high. And that's all that we do. With valuation-informed indexing, we just take that idea and say, we'll apply that to the purchase of an index fund. You can buy an index fund today. They weren't available in Benjamin Graham's time. But you can buy an index fund today, and you'll get the return of the market. But when the market goes crazy, when valuations are crazy dangerous, you will be protected. You'll get down to a 25% allocation. So the hit that you will suffer in the stock crash will be much less than that suffered by others. And on the other hand, when the long-term value proposition is just amazingly great, you'll be participating fully in it. So that's a Benjamin Graham idea. He's the first person I know of to have really put that idea forward. But he had a statement near the end of his life when he talked about how, and I can't quote it here, I don't have the paper in front of me, but he had a statement where he said, it's not as easy today to find values in the market as it once was. When fewer people were participating, Benjamin Graham was able to find companies that would provide very high returns and he could invest, you know, very successfully. And he said, it's just not that easy to do anymore. And that's an argument. It's an argument for indexing, I think. It doesn't say that you have to index, but it's an argument for the average person perhaps using an index fund rather than trying to find individual stocks that are going to do well. He didn't say stock picking can never work, and obviously Warren Buffett engages in stock picking. But he did say that stock picking is for the sophisticated investor. It takes work. It's not easy. And it's harder today than it was once upon a time. All that makes sense. But I have seen passive investors take that statement and they will quote it and they will say, oh, Benjamin Graham favors passive investing. He doesn't think you need to pay attention to valuations. He agrees with all the passive investing dogmatists. And that's a lie. Benjamin Graham does not agree with the passive investing dogmatist. He agrees with something they say. Well, I agree with much of what they say. But he doesn't agree with the part that they say that is nonsense. And I don't agree with the part they say that's nonsense. And I would be offended if someone were to say that I'm an advocate of passive investing. Now, if someone says I'm an advocate of John Bogle, I don't have a problem with that. I'm a Boglehead. I'm a big Bogle fan. I rank him among the top five investing analysts that I've ever read. So fine. And Bogle, of course, endorses passive investing. But that's Bogle's great mistake. So these distinctions are distinctions that need to be made by any honest, responsible person. And yet you see that mistake. I've seen that fallacy. I've seen that error committed a dozen times, more than a dozen times. Over and over and over again, people say it. So there should be a Snopes.com site that will point that out to people. And there's lots of them. There's lots of them you can include. One that I'll just mention one other and then move forward. But something that I just find appalling, and this is on the other side of the story. I remember there was a long thread once at the Early Retirement Forum. Someone was pulling some sort of statistic from Yahoo.com, some article on investing, and it made stocks look very bad, and people were shocked by it. And John Walter Russell came into the thread, and he was able to analyze the numbers. You couldn't tell just from reading the article where the flaw was. Well, you know, Russell looked at it, and he found out for us what the flaw was, and the flaw was they didn't include dividends. You know, they reported what stocks, you know, the return on stocks, not counting dividends. And I've seen that again. I've seen it dozens of times. And it's just fallacious. If you don't count dividends, dividends are part of the return from stocks. So it's wrong not to include dividends. Now, there may be particular circumstances where you want to indicate something without including dividends. I've said there's three times in the past when we went to the valuation levels that we went to in this past, you know, bull market. And on those three occasions, the average price drop was 68%. So we should expect a price drop of somewhere in the neighborhood of 68% this fourth time. And that number does not include dividends. It's just the drop in the stock price. And I always feel uneasy when I give it because I don't think it's proper. But I see arguments both ways. I want to have a dramatic number. John Walter Russell once did the number if you included dividends, and it was, of course, a lower number, something like 40%. And I try to do is just to report both numbers so that people know. But I want to report the 68% because I want to get people's attention. And people are hearing so much of this, you know, pro-stock propaganda that they need to hear that they're going, you know, they're probably going to see a drop in prices of 68%. But I also want them to understand that it's the 68% isn't as bad as it sounds. And I did a blog entry once that went through why the 68% is not as bad as it sounds. So I think it's important, you know. Yeah, what I would like it, though, if there were a database where even when I use that 68% number, it'd be good if people would come in and say, Rob, that doesn't include dividends. Here's a link to the Snopes.com, you know, investingsnopes.com. That would be helpful because I like to include it, and I can't always include reference to the dividend issue because it makes the post too long. It gets too complicated. But it's good if someone comes in and makes the point because it's a valid, legitimate point. It needs to be made. And I do make it. When I feel that I can make it, I do make it. And I want people, in the short term, I want people to be shocked by the 68% number. I want people to be worried. I want people to try to protect their assets. On the other hand, I want people to learn how investing works. And part of it is to understand that 68% drop is not the end of the world. It's a serious hit, and you need to know about it. It's a real thing, and I don't like it when the passive investing enthusiasts sort of, you know, shrug it off. Oh, it's not that big a deal. But I also think it's an error in the other direction to ignore the fact that the 68% drop, that's the worst, and that's not going to remain in effect for all time. And even at that worst point, the loss isn't really 68% because if you count valuations, it might be only 40%. I mean, if you count dividends, it might be only 40%. So it would help us all if we had an investingsnopes.com. And what would happen, the beauty of it is, we wouldn't always have to link to investingsnopes.com. At some point, the people who use these fallacies to trick us would become aware that investingsnopes.com is out there, and they would just stop using the fallacies because it would make them look bad. When somebody puts at a discussion board, oh, here's a link to investingsnopes.com, it makes them look bad. So they would stop this practice of using these fallacious claims. And everyone would learn more about how investing really works. And so that would help us in our move to a more rational approach to investing, in my belief. Item number 10, encourage stories of quote-unquote losers. Investing discussion boards are a powerful medium for learning how investing works. But one of the big problems is, well, of course, one of the problems on the internet is that people lie. You know, just to put it bluntly, passive investors, passive investors, they lie. Not all of them, of course, not most of them, but some of them. The more dogmatic they are, the more likely they are to lie, in my experience. And they will lie about their own results. And I've seen this. You know, I don't know what people's results are. So you could say, how do you know they're lying, Rob? Well, you know it because you can see them on one thread. If you get to know some of the personalities, you can see them on one thread discussing something. And then on another thread, when they're under challenge, they'll tell a different story about the same fact. And both things can't be true. They either lied in thread A or they lied in thread B. One of the ones that I think qualifies as a lie, it certainly qualifies as a deception if it's not quite a lie, is that passive investors will say they constantly will change what it is you're supposed to be invested in. They say, oh, I believe you should invest for the long term. You should pick one investment and stick with it, not change. And somebody will say, well, what should that investment be? They'll say, oh, the S&P 500. And then we'll have 3 years where the S&P 500 does poorly. And they'll say, oh, I've always said you should stick with one thing, and it should be REITs. You know, you should be invested 50% in REITs. And then REITs will have two bad years. And then they'll say, I've always said you should be invested in only one thing and never change. And it should be a combination of the S&P, REITs, and small caps. small cap funds. You know, and then the next year, you always should be invested. Well, nothing in the S&P, but, you know, 40% REITs and 30% small caps and 20% emerging markets. The mix changes every 6 months. You know, always invest in the same thing, but always change it to keep the numbers looking good. You know, that's gibberish. That's gibberish. If passive investing worked, the passive investing enthusiast would be willing to say what it is that you're supposed to buy and hold. But of course, the problem is when the S&P was shooting up every year, they were happy to say the S&P 500 does the trick. It's a broad index fund. But now the S&P has performed poorly for so long that you don't find anyone today saying you can invest solely in the S&P index fund. That won't do it. But they're jiggering all the numbers. They're just engaging in the same trickery that people who invested in individual stocks or people who engaged in short-term timing engaged in long before this. People who engage in short-term timing play the same game. They say, oh, I think stocks are going to go down 20% over the next 6 months. I'm out of stocks. And then at the end of 6 months, you'd say, well, didn't you say stocks were going to go down? Didn't you say you were out of stocks? And they'd say, oh, yes, but my indicators told me on the third week in that they were going to go up. The indicators changed, and I put all my money in stocks, and, oh, I'm way ahead of the game now. Anyone can tell you whether stocks are going to go up or down after it's happened. That's a game that short-term timers have been playing from time immemorial. Now it's just a game that passive investors have adopted as their own. Passive investors play the same exact game all the time. This is why I talked earlier about behavioral finance 2.0. Go to discussion boards and you'll see this. Watch what people say and then check up on them. Don't just take them at their word. Check up on them 6 months down the road. When they say, oh, I believe S&P 500 will work, that's all you need. Check whether they stick to that when the S&P 500 crashes. Then you'll hear a different story. And, of course, if the model needs to be changed every 6 months, it's not really a long-term investing model. Well, what we could learn from, instead of having people change their advice or change their recommendations, what we need to hear is, oh, I thought the S&P 500 would work, and it did it, you know? It did it. I've been crushed. That's a story we can learn from. We can all learn from mistakes. But what goes on at discussion boards, and I think what goes on at discussion boards is representative of what goes on elsewhere, is we all want to hear from winners. We all want to hear from winners. I know this because I have this directed at me. I got out of stocks in 1996. Stocks, I knew from looking at the historical data that stocks were insanely high priced, and I knew that I could not afford to be invested in stocks given my personal financial circumstances. And I was ahead of the game. At the time we had all these discussions, the great safe withdrawal rate debate, we did the numbers on a discussion board and I was ahead. My decision to get out of stocks had been a good one. But hundreds of times, the passive investing dogmatist would put a post saying, oh, Rob is down. Rob has lost money following his strategies. Now, it wasn't true. But they know the power of that. They know that people want to look to winners. And I think, you know, it's human nature. It's human nature to look to winners. There's a reason why the people they put on television commercials or television programs are good looking, because humans look at them and we look to people who are good looking or strong or rich or smart as leaders. But often in the investing game, we can learn more from hearing the stories of the losers. We can learn what we need to avoid. And so we need to encourage those people to speak up. And so many times at discussion boards, I have seen those people try to tell their stories. I have seen people come forward and say, I am in retirement. I tried the old school safe withdrawal rate studies. I have been crushed. My early retirement has failed. And it's failed because I relied on these quote-unquote studies. And I want to hear those people tell their stories. I want everybody to learn from it. And what the passive investing dogmatists say is, oh, you're a loser. Go away. You're not welcome at this board. You're dumb. You're stupid. You're so stupid. You don't know how to invest. We know, but you don't. All that the losers are people. They're trying to succeed. The losers are showing us the weaknesses in our strategies. And the fact that some of us don't want to hear about the weaknesses is not a sign that the strategies are good. It's a sign that the strategies are weak. Defensiveness is a bad sign. So I would like to hear lots of stories of losers. That would help us all. It would take the edge off of a lot of these irresponsible recommendations to stay at high stock allocations at times of high prices. When you hear the stories of some of the painful experiences investors who overinvested in stocks have lived through, that hits with impact. So we need to hear those stories. Item 11. We need independent investing journalism. I'm a journalist. I made my living in earlier years covering Capitol Hill, covering tax legislation for a number of newsletters. And I find the state of investing journalism a sorry thing to behold. There are people who try, but there's so many things wrong with it. And I've tried to alert people in the field, big names that that the old school retirement studies are flawed, that they're going to cause millions of retirements. I can't imagine a bigger story than that. I remember the reaction I got from USA Today. I wrote an email, pointing to the retirement risk evaluator, a calculator at my website that reports the safe withdrawal rate accurately. It's the first calculator on the internet that does that. A new school safe withdrawal rate calculator. And the old school studies, presuming that stocks perform in the future somewhat as they always have in the past, the old school studies are going to cause millions of busted retirements. Could you ask for a bigger news story? The answer I got back from USA Today, not for us. Not for us. I know that USA Today is read by businessmen, and businesswomen. It's read on airplanes and things like that. And I know these people have money. I know that they're trying to plan their retirements. I know that USA Today likes to do these graphics, colorful graphics. Well, the retirement risk evaluator is uses the primary colors in the graphics it creates when you plug in the various assumptions. So I think it works perfectly for a cover article on USA Today. But there's just not interest among a lot of investing journalists in telling people the realities of stock investing. And what they rely on in so often is, the quote-unquote experts. How many, ask yourself this question the next time you read an article on investing. Look at the sources. Look at the people quoted. How many of them have ties to the stock selling industry? It's a high percentage. Now, imagine you were trying to learn how to buy a car. And every source that was cited, was the owner of a car dealership. Bob's Hot Cars says, you should always be in the market for cars. Cars are great. Replace your car every 6 months. You don't want to be driving an old car. You want a new car. You want the shiniest car. You want the newest model. Girls will go for you if you own more cars. We would laugh. If such an article appeared, we would laugh. How pathetic it is. But that's the kind of article we get in the investing area. Stocks for the long run. Stocks are always good to buy. Don't worry about price. Just hold on to those stocks. Buy more stocks. If you want to retire, you got to have a lot of stocks. Timing doesn't work. Don't ever lower your stock allocation. When stock prices fall, stocks are a bargain. They're great. But when stock prices are high, don't worry about prices. Prices don't matter. Prices only matter after a stock crash. Then you've got to buy more. You got to always buy a lot, and then you got to buy even more. So there's two speeds with stock investing. There's buy a lot, and there's buy more. Those are the two speeds, according to the quote-unquote experts. The experts. What are they expert at exactly? They're expert at selling stocks. That's what they're expert at. But, can we blame them? What would you expect them to say? I don't applaud them. I don't applaud them for that behavior, but I think the primary blame has to be on the journalists who are quoting these people, and of course the editors who permit it. These claims of people with ties to the stock selling industry need to be balanced by claims from more independent sources, people who are willing to give us the straight story. We need a Consumer Reports in the investing realm, a publication that's not beholden to people selling stocks for a living. And I remember, it used to drive me a little crazy. I remember when I was, when I was doing daily journalism, I had a boss at one of my jobs, and he would say, he had a rule, and some people didn't like it, but he had a rule that said, it was common for reporters to take their sources out to lunch. You want to get to know them. So you sit over lunch with them. But he had a rule that we cannot allow a source to take us to lunch. So if somebody in the Treasury Department offered to take you to lunch, you had to either say no or you had to pay for your own lunch. You cannot allow someone to pay for your lunch. And I understand why he had the rule, and in many ways it's a good rule. But the thing that always drove me a little bonkers about it is the suggestion was that if somebody bought you a lunch, it would bias you. You would want to favor them. And of course that can happen. But that sort of bias I never really saw as a problem in practical experience. But there was a huge bias in terms of the sources you had, because it was our job to find out what was going on in tax bills, and to find out you had to talk to the congressional aides. And so you couldn't write a story if the congressional aides wouldn't help you. And so you were always inclined, say especially when one party always controls the committee. It's either the Democrats or the Republicans, control the tax committee, depending on who controls Congress at the time. So you were never going to be critical of if the Democrats controlled the committee, you were always going to be careful what you said. Because if you get that aide unhappy with you, you're cut off and you can't write your articles. Well, that was the real bias. That was a problem. And I think it's that way in investing journalism. When all of your sources come from the stock selling industry, this is what I was talking about with indexuniverse.com. I think that indexuniverse.com should be running articles on valuation-informed indexing. I think it's the future of indexing. I know that I've gotten great reaction to it among investors. I've gotten, you know, abusive reactions from big shots, people who have advocated passive indexing, hate it because they're threatened by it. And I contacted Index Universe. The publisher was excited about the article. He said it was a great idea. He read the article. He said, I don't see anything wrong with this. He says, what's all the controversy about? You know, why do these people hate you? This is common sense. But then he sent it on to the editorial guy. And the editorial guy, no, too hot to handle. And then I noticed they start running a lot of articles by people with connections with Mel Lindauer and the Bogleheads.org. You know, they start running articles. They have these summaries of threads at Bogleheads.org. Well, Bogleheads.org has banned discussion evaluation informed indexing at their site. It's flat out prohibited. Well, Bogleheads.org has power in the indexing field today. So this site, my belief is that Index Universe is afraid to come out against Bogleheads.org. And, of course, Bogle himself has implicitly endorsed Bogleheads.org. He allowed them to use his name. He speaks at their conference. Now, you know, I'm a big Bogle fan, but I don't think he should be using his influence in that way. I think he should separate himself, especially when they ban, when they prohibit honest and informed posting on key issues, like the question of whether passive indexing works or whether valuation-informed indexing is a better approach. He should be hands-off on that. And if they ban it, I think he should remove himself in every way from participation in that community. And I think Index Universe should take a hands-off approach. They should remove themselves. It's a conflict. And, that's poor journalism in Rob Bennett's view. But it's endemic in the investing journalism field. I see it everywhere. It's bad stuff. I'm going to wrap this one up. I'll get to item 12 in the future of investing part 3. Good luck with your investing strategies.